This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
So I guess I'm part of a conversation going on in Canada and the U.S. and around the world as to what's green these days. What is in the interests of the commonweal?
We all know the creatures of the earth are in dire straits. Billions of humans, more tens of billions of our food animals, all slashing down the landscape, denuding the oceans, and polluting the atmosphere. Unless we can make a drastic change, the climate is headed for a catastrophic shift. Are we ready for desperate measures? Stuart Brand became a household name in the 1970s with his Whole Earth Catalog, the tool that connected it to do-it-yourself energy and back-to-the-land implements for an alternative culture. Now he's back with friends in high places and a big business frame of mind. Brand is promoting his new book, Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto, now in an updated paperback edition. These are not my positions. You be the judge. Here is a conversation with Stuart Brand, recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock on October 5th, 2010, in Vancouver, Canada.
I gave a presentation last night, and I'm going to give another one tonight. And so this is not a presentation. This is a conversation. And just out in paperback, this book largely deals with, I'm a lifelong environmentalist who is lately trying to see what green means in this century as opposed to back in the 1970s, when the so-called modern environmental movement was pretty much invented in response to the images of Earth from space that we got from 1969 on. The approach I'm taking is that we're in a different situation. We know different things about climate now than we did then. We have vastly more sophisticated technologies for energy and other things. On the other hand, biotech is better. Energy, solar and wind have become important. We're learning things about the downside as well as the upside of those. Nuclear technology is matured and moving on. And prospects of geoengineering, of direct intervention in the climate, is something that is now being contemplated that was unimaginable back in the 1970s. And we've learned a lot more about restoring wildlands, which is a major interest I have. So I guess I'm part of a conversation going on in Canada and the U.S. and around the world as to what's green these days. What is in the interests of the commonweal? What is the common good that can be maintained for the longest time with the tools we have to hand? And that's our discussion. So what would you guys like to talk about?
I'm interested in the interim to the solutions that you talked about last night that you can see coming down the road, perhaps decades away. Just the general wacko factor as things collapse and politics get strange. With all the technology we potentially have, I have a thing on my shoulder that says yeah, but politics and madness, what are some of the roadblocks and challenges due to the chaotic nature of the world in general?
I think this is a great question to ask. You know, how does the political aspects of all this play out? The science is, you know, the scientific argument is moving forward. We're getting better and better data. We're getting better and better models about climate, about all these things. People are still understanding that science is an argument. And scientists are still understanding that politics is an argument. They were astounded to find that once they said, hey, we've got to mitigate greenhouse gases, please do it as quickly as possible. And for a large amount of time, the political argument is, you don't know what you're talking about, or you do know what you're talking about, but you're wrong, or there's some kind of plot that you're actually operating in the agenda of, and the scientists are going to say, what? I've just given you the facts, now act on them. And that's not the way the political debate goes forward. And it's not the pace at which the political debate goes forward. And every time the political debate hears about action in the scientific debate, the political debate, in a sense, gets exacerbated because some people are saying, well, if the scientists don't agree, why should we act? And is there any reason to think the political debate will come to some kind of enough of a completion for things to actually move forward at the pace at which crisis seems to be emerging in terms of climate and everything else? Extrapolating from right now, probably not. Take the worst case, the hardest case. The hardest case is geoengineering. Enough of the world agreeing that we have to do something direct about climate and put sulfur dioxide, pretend to be a volcano, put sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere and cool the planet directly, just the way Mount Pinatubo did in 1991. The litigation alone suggests that no way you get international agreement about that. The other major problem there that people see is that the cost of doing that, of putting sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere like a volcano, is maybe as low as $300 million a year to cool the planet by 3 degrees Celsius. Well, there's probably people in Vancouver who can afford to do that. There's certainly a lot of nations that can afford to do that. And so what's talked about, the idea of unilateral geoengineering, is the new kind of bete noire that many people have, that this could be very scary. So you need international agreements. There is no UN law that has now been determined by people looking at this that covers this. The question is whether the United Nations would even be, you know, an adequate entity to handle it. And so it could well be that we get to a case where the climate is running away. Everybody knows it's running away. We're having typhoons and droughts and all the stuff that was warned about. And a lot of people are saying, oh my God, we've got to do Plan B, geoengineering, to buy time in order to mitigate greenhouse gases. And enough people understand that has to happen, but not enough people understand that has to happen to get international agreements that all the people downwind of each other, which is everybody when you're talking about a global climate. And it could well be we disagree ourselves to death. And then there's feedbacks in that, such that once you get serious droughts going on, once you get, say, the rivers of Asia that are fed by the glaciers of the Himalayan plateau, when they dry up in the summer, and now what the Mekong goes to, I think, six nations, not many of whom like each other, and the guys downstream, we're already seeing this in some areas, in the Mekong as one, somewhat in the Indus. The people downstream get deprived of water by the guys upstream, and they fight over it. Once that fighting starts at a global scale, people taking sides and all the rest of it, then how do you get agreement of any sort about geoengineering or anything else? So the worst case is pretty bad, and the best cases are none too good. So a whole lot of how this stuff moves forward, I think your question raises, and we'll pursue it, is how does this play out politically?
Do you believe that society has advanced at the same pace as the technology? Have people changed significantly?
They keep saying that human nature hasn't changed much since at least the Greeks. So we read the Greek tragedies and feel right at home with the problems being presented there. If a modern Oedipus marries his mother, we'd be just as alarmed probably as they were. Society is made of communication. And communication technology has changed so enormously that a whole lot of people are tweeting a whole lot of people simultaneously or maintaining a kind of friendship that never existed before, friending on Facebook, are asynchronously communicating through email, are cell phoning. Cell phones took off so rapidly, the poorest people in the world have them and are using them to get out of poverty. So there's no change in human nature involved there, but the nature of human activity has. And democracy was invented and reinvented before we had these things. And so group decision-making is probably going to go through a couple of transformations in the next couple of decades, and may be driven by things like the very issue of how do we agree enough globally to take global action in relation to global problems. The last time we did that, it was done by governments. That was the Cold War. And basically, behind vast barriers of secrecy, the Soviet Union and the United States managed to keep the Cold War cold. And we, the people, didn't have much say in that. This time, the governments have a huge play, much more than I used to think in libertarian Whole Earth Catalog days. They had value. But now they have to do things like make coal expensive and do other things to seriously mitigate greenhouse gases in the long term, and maybe take these kind of actions in the short term. I don't think we need to change human nature. If we need it, we could do that with drugs, but I don't think it's necessarily going to happen. But if the nature of communication changes enough and we adapt to getting the best value from it enough, like there's a shot. All of this is there's just a shot. I mean, the default case is James Lovelock describes just actually this afternoon, since I generated a slide, I might as well use it, what we're looking at. This is a restoration project. We're trying to restore climate to what it has been for the last 10,000 years. Civilization has never known anything other than a pretty benign long summer, as it's called. And so one choice is business as usual. And it gets about, James Lovelock's version is, it goes about 5 degrees Celsius warmer than we have now over a period of a few decades, maybe a century. That has a carrying capacity for maybe a billion, billion and a half people. The tropical areas, the rainforest dies. All the species in them die. Those parts of the world become basically uninhabitable, and everybody moves to Vancouver. It's easier for the northern hemisphere because, as you may have noticed, the landmass is mostly in the northern hemisphere, and the continents tend to narrow in the southern hemisphere. So as things get warmer and drier and people head toward the poles, there's more in the north than there is in the south. That's not a world you really want. So the restoration we would like to see is to maintain something like we've had. You've heard about the medieval hot spell, that's it right there, and the so-called ice age around 1600 is there. So within that range, pretty good at keeping civilization going. That's the problem set for this century. Even doing the science properly to some extent depends on good, better politics. We need to be doing the science now on geoengineering, start testing at scale some of the various half dozen schemes that are out there. Some environmentalists, Environmental Defense Fund is now, in the U.S., is now sponsoring research into geoengineering. That's unimaginable 10 or 15 years ago that any environmental organization would suggest tampering with Gaia, playing God, defying nature, all those bad things we're not supposed to do if we're good greens. They're stepping up to the scale of the problem. And not everybody's done that, not everybody will. But all you need is rough consensus and running code, as they say in the Internet Engineering Task Force, to have at least the research go forward. To then to deploy these kinds of technologies takes more than rough consensus. It takes real agreement.
On your graph, you project a downturn in the temperature. What is that based on? Is it due to technological change or behavioral change?
Yeah, everything. Lots of wind, lots of solar, lots of nuclear. Maybe some geoengineering to sort of buy time, because this is actually on the order of a century right here. What you worry about is going across tipping points that even though you start to mitigate a little better, it's already too late and you're firing into the oceans. The Lovelock version of this is that basically the oceans stop running the atmosphere. They stratify and basically die because they get too warm, as they did 55 million years ago. And then the continents take over. And the continents would run a warmer Gaia. At least that's what happened back in the Eocene. Whatever it is, transition, when it really was a lot warmer. There are crocodiles in the polar ocean.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are listening to an intimate afternoon with Stuart Brand, author of Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto.
What is the cause? Not of just CO2, but the fundamental cause of the environmental damage.
Early success. Happens a lot in biology. I was trained in ecology way back when, so it's been great fun having to catch up on what's going on in the science the last 50 years. Big boom, semi-bust is the mode with any invasive species, and we're the world's greatest invasive species ever. So you come into an area like North America and leave a bloody trail. And we killed all the megafauna and started burning the place, and then the Europeans showed up. Well, actually, there's a lot of agriculture going on before the Europeans got here, and then a lot more once we did, plus diseases and, you know, things going back and forth. And then things settled down. So we're, in a sense, what I think we're in the midst of is an invasive species that is settling down. We've run out of continents to invade. We're not actually expanding anything like the rate we used to. We will probably top out certainly below, to my eye, 9 billion by mid-century, maybe as low as 8 billion by mid-century, and then drop rapidly because of, as a guy named Hazeltine put it once, independent of culture everywhere in the world, as soon as women get economic independence, they stop reproducing our species. And fertility rate is below replacement, 2.1 children per woman, in over half the countries in the world now. It's quite low in some places. Italy has 1.3 children per woman. Brazil has 1.3 children per woman. At that rate, you basically half your population in 45 years. If you keep that rate, then you half the population again in the next 45 years. So you're talking about within one century going to a quarter of what you had before. Japan and Russia are already losing population. So the sense I have is that we've peaked anyway. And that's part of what makes this an interesting century, because we're going through the dealing with the harm we caused, becoming an enormous, overwhelmingly dominant species, to finding out how to blend in a little better. Plus, the success that we're having is less and less dependent on killing megafauna. In fact, we now have the capability of bringing back the mammoth and the mastodon and the saber-toothed tiger, which will probably be somewhat limited in its range. But we can do those things. We can bring back Neanderthals. This is now within the skill set that humans have. That's an amazing transition.
And behind that? Why have humans risen to such dominance?
There's a book that's just now coming out by Kevin Kelly called What Technology Wants. It's the only predictive theory of history I've seen that actually works. And for technology, cities are technology. Sexual recombination is technology. Cells are technology. There is a trend that seems to have its own agenda of things getting more and more capable. Start with the stars and go on right through us to whatever's next. And we happen to, by virtue of, who knows, some event that happened in Africa, coming out of the trees and having hands available and the ability to make voices that became speech, that became writing, that became all this stuff that gave us the ability to do cultural evolution drastically faster than biological evolution. Even the kind of biological evolution that microbes do, which is an hourly genetic engineering of passing genes among various species. So we were the ones that, luckily I guess, got endowed with the leading edge of the technological imperative and are still comprehending the responsibilities that entails. So that sense of responsibility has been, I think, growing. The capability of acting on that responsibility is growing. But the realization takes a while. You know, when you're successful, the first thing that somebody who's getting really rich does is make a lot of mistakes. We're in that category. And we didn't have any, you know, imagine you were the first rich person. Here's the problem. Rich people who get rich now, they can look around and see people who've really blown it. They've distorted their kids. They've blown it all on drugs, the suicide within a decade, whatever it might be. That's because you can look around and see the ones doing it right and doing it wrong. And so a Warren Buffett and a Bill Gates can kind of inspire each other to be incredibly good and useful and helpful at being rich. And when we came along, there was nobody to, you know, who were we supposed to study? Porcupines? So we're having to invent, and this is Bill Gates' line. You know, we try a thing, we fall down, we stumble, we pick ourselves up, stumble along again. He says, it's a stumbling game. All you can hope for is that you're stumbling in the right direction. And I think we are getting a sense of direction.
My fear about genetics, it's being done mainly by one big company, Monsanto.
Used to be, not anymore, but go ahead.
And they went for ownership of seeds with Terminator seeds, and that created quite a scare. And the same could be said about nuclear. It takes great big companies or governments to do it. So I'm worried that the technologies and choices that you are advocating themselves lead toward, whether we want it or not, kind of a dictatorial format rather than a bottom-up series of solutions. How would you answer that?
I don't think it's either or. One of the things I've grown to be unhappy about with the environmental movement is that it went from being a right-wing thing, which it was back in the early part of the last century. When I gave my pledge as an American to save and faithfully to defend from waste the natural resources of my country, its air, soil, metals, its forests, waters, and wildlife back in 1952, I got that from Outdoor Life. It was a hunting and fishing magazine. And Teddy Roosevelt and Duck Hunters were the leading preservationists in the world. They were conservatives. And then it flipped. And remember, progress used to belong to progressives. And then somehow it flipped, and progressives got scared by progress. In a sense, you just stated a form of the progressive fear of progress, that it's being driven by a capitalist engine that they distrust, and sometimes with very good reason. Green came to mean left. And so anybody who didn't much like liberals, and there's plenty of reasons not to like liberals, then decided they were, if liberals were green, then if you're conservative, you have to be anti-green. So this weird flip happened. The sort of generalized design solution is to compress the deleterious things, compress the human deleteriousness into compact cities, compress the wild fishing that we do, overfishing the oceans, into good mariculture and good aquaculture, which is taking off worldwide. Compress your energy production into things like nuclear, and then the nuclear waste is tremendously concentrated. There's not very much of it. It's easily controlled, and if you decide you don't want it after a while, it's easy to stick in very stable parts of the ground and forget about it. So whereas coal waste goes in and fills everybody's atmosphere and cooks the world, I would love to see us cutting no more wild trees. Growing trees in plantations is a really effective way to get what you want from trees, whether it's pulp or plywood or lumber, and let the wild trees go and do their guy and thing, and we can stroll amongst them. In Australia, I make a beef in the book about, there's the tallest hardwood in the world, it's called Eucalyptus regnans, 300 feet high. Gorgeous trees in Tasmania. Some of them are protected. Most of them are being cut down and chipped for cardboard. I can't imagine. It's like breaking up a Stradivarius violin to make firewood kindling. And we don't need to do that for cardboard. So concentrate these things, and I think that's the sort of thing that Lovelock is referring to, is stay away from some of the really dilute landscape tearing up forms of agriculture and energy farming. Food farming and energy farming, I guess, is the way to combine them.
We have run out of time for this week. From this conversation with Stuart Brand, author of Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto. Find an online version of the book at this website, sbnotes.com. That's sbnotes.com. Brand is among those who have made a shift toward the unthinkable, massive construction of nuclear power to avert climate change, geoengineering to stop the heat until we can make that shift, genetically engineered food to help agriculture survive drought, floods, heat, or new insects, the big technical fix, almost the complete opposite of the do-it-yourself, localized mentality made famous in the 1970s Whole Earth Catalog.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.